Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight on the forum, KKFI's own Spencer Graves will discuss changes in local news coverage, especially in investigative journalism, and how those changes affect the community. Journalism is the watchdog of democracy. As media organizations migrate to platforms that favor click counts and social media likes over time-tested journalistic principles, Graves believes that the people, in particular local people, and not just the rich and powerful corporations that own major national newspapers and networks, should have a say in defining what news is and isn't, especially with regards to local news. Towards the end of the broadcast, Graves introduces some interesting ideas on what we can do to solve this problem, including right here at KKFI. This show was recorded on March 3rd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Welcome to the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Forum. I am Walt Wells. I'm a member of the church and the forum committee. And we invite anybody who happens to be checking in on us on social media to join us there. Our subject at the forum this morning is local media. Think for yourself. How did you know it was going to snow today? What did you use other than sticking your head out the door to know how much there was or what the traffic was like? And who owns that media, whether it was online, broadcast, or print? That's the general subject of what we're about today. Spencer Graves is our speaker this morning. Spencer is on the board of Friends of Community Media, KKFI, and also very active with PeaceWorks. And these bring him in touch with local issues. I'm going to turn it over to Spencer, and he will be available for a while after the forum for anybody that wishes to discuss issue in more detail. Spencer Graves.
Thank you, Walt. Thank you very much. Thank you. So I want to start by noting that my key message today is that the mainstream media create the stage upon which politicians read their lines, and that the people in this room can do things that will help improve the functioning of our political economy here in Kansas City and maybe worldwide to benefit everyone. The Washington Post says, and I need to turn this thing on, that democracy dies in darkness. The mainstream commercial broadcasters in the United States fired nearly all their investigative journalists in the last quarter of the 20th century, except for a handful that worked for popular programs like 60 Minutes. The broadcasters found ways to retain most of their audience while reducing the threats that investigative journalists pose to major advertisers who do not want to subsidize unfriendly coverage of disgruntled customers or employees or neighbors or of special favors they may be seeking from government. And since the advent of the internet, newspapers are dying everywhere. James Fitzpatrick, a journalist for the Kansas City Star for many years, recently said that the Star had more than 2,000 employees in 2006. They had about 250 a month or two ago, and they may have fewer than 200 at the end of the current year. Research on the political economy of journalism has documented what has happened when the quality of local news has declined. On average, fewer people ran for political office. Less money was spent on elections. Incumbent politicians did not work as hard for their constituents. And the cost of government went up. I believe we can reverse the attacks on our democracy represented by inadequate news coverage, but we need to understand the threat and respond appropriately. To make this discussion more productive while I speak, I hope you will take the opportunity to jot down on a piece of paper the biggest opportunities you see for improvements in the local political economy, the gaps that you see in the news, and that might be achieved with better journalism, and then what you might be willing to do to help fix these problems. I served 6 years in the U.S. Air Force during the Vietnam War. I went into the military believing it was my patriotic duty. I had been on active duty for 6 months when it came to me that the South Vietnamese ought to have a home team advantage. So why did they need foreign troops when their enemies, the Viet Cong, did not? I later learned that former President Eisenhower said in his 1963 autobiography that he had never communicated with anyone knowledgeable in Indochinese affairs, including Vietnam, who did not agree that if elections had been held in the early 1950s, the communist Ho Chi Minh might have gotten 80%, that's 80%, of the popular vote. I want to repeat that. Eisenhower never communicated with anyone who seemed to know anything about Vietnam who did not agree that the communist Ho Chi Minh might have gotten 80% of the popular vote in elections, if elections had been held. That point was completely absent from the mainstream political discourse in the U.S. at that time. Instead, the discourse was dominated by concerns about godless satanic communism, the knock on the door in the middle of the night, and people just disappeared, tortured to death, or sent to slave labor camps in places like Siberia. Evidently, the mainstream media in the 1950s and 60s suppressed an extremely important aspect of the universal consensus of experts about Vietnam, to the point that Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford felt compelled to vigorously oppose democracy in Vietnam. These behaviors of the media make sense if you consider that the business model of every media organization is to sell changes in the behaviors of their audience to their funders, the people who give them money. If you do not have an audience, you have nothing to sell and will not be in business for long. If the audience does not change behaviors, or worse, if they change behaviors in ways that displease the funders, advertisers for commercial media in the U.S., will likely find other uses for their money. The mainstream media create the stage upon which politicians read their lines. The media have this power because of a fundamental defect in how people think and make decisions, documented in research led by Daniel Kahneman, who won the 2002 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. Kahneman is a research psychologist. He is not an economist. He won the Nobel Prize in Economics for research that showed that the standard models that economists have used for the rational person is not how people actually think. People make most decisions intuitively based on what comes most readily to mind. Kahneman calls this fast thinking. We are capable of more careful thought, deliberation, and search for evidence. Kahneman's slow thinking, but we are not very good at identifying when we need to do so. The mainstream media everywhere exploit this defect in human thought processes to balkanize and exploit the body politic, to benefit those who control media funding and governance. Let me describe another example. The incarceration rate in the United States today is 5 times what it was 50 years ago. After having been stable at 0.1% of the U.S. population between 1925 and 1975, the incarceration rate in the United States shot up by a factor of 5 in the last quarter of the 20th century. The explanation for this increase that I have found most persuasive is changes in the editorial policies of the mainstream commercial broadcasters. As I said before, between 1975 and the year 2000, they fired nearly all of their investigative journalists, replacing them with the police blotter. People thought that crime was out of control, when in fact there had been no substantive change in crime, and the public voted for a generation of politicians to get tough on crime. And this is the result. Today, the vast majority of incarcerees are high school dropouts incarcerated for nonviolent drug offenses. My study of the relevant research suggests that criminalizing substance abuse generally creates more problems than it solves, similar to prohibition of alcohol between 1920 and 1933. The best response, according to the best research I've seen, is drug treatments, not incarcerations. We need more and better research on which drug treatment programs are most effective, which programs for children are most likely to increase what children actually learn and reduce, also to reduce the dropout problem. And we need a media system that provides better coverage of the issues of the scientific consensus on matters that what matters most to the bottom 99.5% of the U.S. population. Notice I said not the 99%, but the 99.5%. That's because the average annual income in the United States gross domestic product per family adjusted for inflation has been growing at a fairly constant 2% per year since 1947, with a few fluctuations like the Great Recession, doubling every 35 years, roughly. Prior to 1970, the incomes of the poor and the rich grew essentially at the same rate, 2% per year. Since 1970, the incomes of the top 0.5% have grown faster than 2% per year, and while the incomes of everyone else have not grown as fast, the gap is roughly $100 a day for the typical American family. It's more dollars, but a lower percent of income for the 99th percentile, and it's fewer dollars, but a higher percent of income for the poor. I claim we would be safer and more prosperous with less income inequality if we had citizen-directed subsidies for journalism. I do not want either government bureaucrats nor corporate bureaucrats censoring the media. Regarding incarcerations and education, we are told that we cannot afford to educate the children of the poor or even, frankly, to do the research to understand what we need to do to reduce or eliminate high school dropouts that feed the school-to-prison pipeline, or how to improve how much the children actually learn. This is silly from several perspectives. First, as I mentioned, the average annual income in the United States today is double what it was 35 or 40 years ago. Clearly, it is a question of priorities, not what we can or cannot afford. We need to fund the research needed to document which educational innovations are effective and which are not. And we need a media system that will disseminate the research consensus even when it conflicts with the scientific, even when it conflicts with the advertising consensus. Second, most of our current incarcerees are there for nonviolent drug offenses. Research says that incarcerating drug abusers does not reduce drug abuse, and it does not make us safer. Meanwhile, drug rehab programs that have been shown to be effective are underfunded. We should stop incarcerating people for nonviolent drug offenses in the same way that we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933. Third, research led by Stanford economist Eric Honoshek documents how countries whose children actually learn more tend to have higher rates of economic growth. He collected test scores on international standardized tests of student achievement and aggregated them by state within the United States and by country internationally. He compared the rate of economic growth in average annual income, real gross domestic product per capita, from 1960 into the 21st century, adjusting both growth rates and test scores for the average annual income at the start of that period. When he compared groups of countries, he got almost a straight line from sub-Saharan Africa with the poorest educated children and the slowest growth to Asia with the best educated children and the fastest economic growth. We all need those kids in school and learning, because our standard of living 15 years from now depends upon it. We need to do the research to find out which educational innovations actually improve student achievement and which only cherry-pick the already high-achieving kids. And we need a media system that will disseminate the research consensus even when it conflicts with the advertising consensus. I want to ground these remarks in a review of U.S. history from the founding of Jamestown Colony in 1607 to the present. The 13 colonies that declared independence from Great Britain in 1776 arguably had the most advanced democratic culture on the planet at that time. Adult white male owners of substantial property could vote, and that happened to include just under 60% of the adult white male population in 1776. Meanwhile, regular newspapers started appearing in the early 1700s. They encouraged literacy, which increased the rate of economic growth consistent with the research of Eric Honoshek discussed earlier. And newspapers and literacy and democratic governance worked together to help limit political corruption, which also seems to improve the rate of economic growth. By 1792, the leaders of these brand new United States of America realized that their experiment in Republican government would likely fail without an informed electorate. They therefore enacted the U.S. Postal Service Act of 1792, under which newspapers were delivered up to 100 miles for a penny, when first-class postage was between 6 and 25 cents, depending upon distance. It was huge. It was 0.2% of our annual income, national income, gross domestic product, according to media scholar Robert McChesney and his co-author John Nichols. You do not need to be perfect to succeed at anything. You only need to be better than the alternatives. At the time of the American Revolution, New Spain ran from the Caribbean through Florida and Louisiana to the Pacific Northwest, with many times the land area of the 13 British colonies that declared independence in 1776. However, New Spain did not have a comparable democratic tradition, nor citizen-directed subsidies for journalism like the U.S. Postal Service Act of 1792. Since that time, New Spain fractured and shrank. It lost most of its territory to the expanding United States. The rest fractured, split into Mexico, a half a dozen countries in Central America, and many island nations in the Caribbean and elsewhere, none of which have had economic growth comparable to that of the United States. The standard description of the founding of the United States is that we got freedom and democracy, liberty and justice for all, from the violence of the American Revolution. I think that description is wrong. Virtually every other successful violent revolution in human history arguably replaced one brutal repressive system with another. So how did we get so lucky to get George Washington and not someone more like Joe Stalin and Napoleon? I've already given you my answer. I think we owe our freedom and democracy, liberty and justice for all, to the advanced democratic culture that had developed between 1607 and 1776, and to the vigorous adversarial press that was reinforced by the citizen-directed subsidies for journalism provided by the U.S. Postal Service Act of 1792. The violence of the American Revolution secured our independence from Great Britain while reducing the threats that democracy posed to the existing leadership. After the Declaration of Independence, the 13 brand new states wrote state constitutions. In Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and perhaps elsewhere, the results threatened the social status of the leaders of the American Revolution. The violence of the revolution helped the colonial elites resist some of these democratic pressures. In the mid-19th century, advertising began to grow to become a major source of funding for newspapers. By the 20th century, advertising had become roughly 2% of national income, gross domestic product, as compared to 0.2% of GDP that provided a century earlier by the U.S. Postal Service Act of 1792. Various researchers have suggested different systems for citizen-directed subsidies suitable for today's world. We need more work on the best way to do this. But I think we should fund investigative journalism at a rate comparable to what we spend on advertising and accounting, both of which are roughly 2% of national income. One more issue. Local governments give money, whether cash or tax credits, to subsidize programs or just looking the other way about environmental issues or whatever, to subsidize programs for economic development under the claim that everyone benefits. We spend tax money on accounting to evaluate the extent to which income and expenses match the plan. We should also spend more tax money on research to document the circumstances under which the social impact is consistent with the claims used to sell those programs. And we should spend tax money further to support citizen-directed subsidies for local journalism to ensure that the scientific consensus is explained to the public, even if it conflicts with the advertising and political consensus. As Walt mentioned, I serve on the boards of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, and of Friends of Community Media because I believe that those two organizations can help to solve the problems that have grown here in Kansas City because of inadequate journalism. A disclaimer, please. These are my own thoughts and are not any official position of KKFI, nor the Friends of Community Media, or anyone else there but me. There are a growing number of nonprofit news organizations in the United States working to fill the gaps led by the cuts that laid off 90% of the employees of the Star in the past 13 years and closed many other newspapers. Almost 200 of these nonprofit news organizations are members of the Institute for Nonprofit News, or INN, which works to identify and share best practices between different nonprofit news organizations. I'm hoping we can start at least one nonprofit news organization here in Kansas City to improve the quality of coverage of events in our metro and bi-state areas. KKFI and the Friends of Community Media are both 501c3 nonprofits with missions compatible with improving news in Kansas City. We could use help from others to build a credible plan with a consensus for action and resources to turn that plan into results. I believe we can create a local political economy that is safer and more prosperous for everyone, with the possible exception of the top half of a percent. Thank you very much. Walt?
We will be entertaining some questions, and I believe Spencer will be available if the questions continue beyond our allotted time today. Please keep your questions short enough that his answers have time to be heard.
I'm going to try to make this a question, not a statement, but my friend Craig Vollen ran for mayor 1 year, many, many years ago. And what we noticed with the media, the mainstream media, was that there would be a stage of candidates that was being interviewed and talking at a public forum. And what we would find is that the two or three people that were designated as the potential winners were viewed on the screen. And very carefully cropped off the side were people like my friend Craig and other people. Gomer noticed that too. Anyway, the transitions you talk about, I mean, I'm curious as to we want this to come back, or we would like to have more people, investigative reporters, with journalism. Yet, even when there were plenty of reporters, this kind of mechanism happened, and it happened not just locally, but nationally. Could you comment on that?
Yes. It's a function of where who manages the funding. So that's exactly why I said I do not want either corporate bureaucrats or government bureaucrats censoring the media like you just described. So we need citizen-directed subsidies for journalism. And there are various ways of doing that. Internet clicks connected to a specific political jurisdiction or voucher system or something, some other kind of proposal system, whatever. We need to experiment with those.
Well, the big guns are like Washington Post and New York Times are looking at the subscription model. And I'm a YouTube junkie, so they're individuals who are trying to get likes and then advertising on their sites, I am assuming. Can you comment on BBC, Russia Today, and maybe Al Jazeera about the pitfalls of government-sponsored versus subscription versus advertising? I know, like, my wife's college roommate does her own blog, but she does it for free. She doesn't have time. She's not getting paid to go out and investigate anything. So it's basically what she hears in the neighborhood, and she's a good writer and she likes to blog. So can you give us sort of like a general view of where we're going here?
Well, that's why I mentioned Robert McChesney, okay? Because, and that's why I mentioned the U.S. Postal Service Act of 1792. We need a modern-day reincarnation of that. Friends of Community Media had a video conference with a leading scholar of journalism. I forget his name now, but I can give it to you after the break. It's available on Wikiversity under category Freedom and Abundance, and you will find a video with a communications challenge to democracy. This media scholar at the University of Wisconsin had led a national effort to identify media gaps, and he said that we have good coverage for very personal things provided by Facebook and that sort of thing, and we have reasonable coverage for the national and international. My example of the Vietnam War. What we're talking about, the political the scientific consensus over global warming, is not being heard. It's the scientific consensus is virtually universal, but the American public doesn't know that. So we need to find a way. We need to understand that media is a public good, and that we need it in order for our democracy to survive, and we need citizen-directed subsidies in some way.
I guess I'm critical of the idea that we need to reform media, that as we've thought of it, and that my concern is, and I like your comment on this, is that it seems to me that we need to live within the constraints of the existing social media system that we have now, because it seems to be what's permeating not only the America's youth, but throughout, even people like myself that have social media accounts. Let me give you an example of MSNBC has a couple of programs on the evenings where they go through and report on stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and they give fairly good analysis of that. And yet, some of these are already out there, analyses on Instagram and in tweets and within Facebook. And so if that is, in fact, what the youth of America are entertaining, then it seems to me that we're going to have we have to embrace rather than castigate that process. Is that your thoughts?
Social media is wonderful and terrible, especially when it's for-profit social media. There's a great book entitled Anti-Social Media by professor of journalism at a university in Virginia. I forget the exact name, but I can certainly give you the... Wikiversity article under that category of Freedom and Abundance that cites it. But he basically says that Facebook's for-profit model has made it. They have so much data on individual characteristics that it has become profitable to target ads to groups as small as 20. And in the political arena, he claims that ads that would seem completely outrageous to the 99% of the population reinforce the racist and extreme positions of that target group and push them to become even more extreme. And I think so that, he says, has contributed to increasing political violence that I think we've seen with two cases of extremist violence here in Kansas City in the past few years. An Indian guy was killed in a bar in Olathe, in 2016, I think, and a few years earlier, some racist guy killed several people at a Jewish community center in Overland Park. But we need to be careful. There are non-commercial social media platforms that have not caught on so far. I'm just haven't found the time to investigate them further to start experimenting with them myself. I'm too busy, sorting out my thoughts for this presentation, for example. Right.
What do you think about newspapers like The Pitch? Is there any hope there? They of course depend on advertisers still, but it seems to be not in the same way like that the Kansas City Star would. Is that an avenue for us to go?
I'm not an expert on The Pitch or other newspapers. I know that newspapers in general, including The Pitch, may be finding a niche and growing in some spaces, but I'm not convinced that it's seriously sustainable. We need to find ways to build non-commercial media organizations, and some of them exist and they're growing. They're just not growing fast enough. Let me here. I've got a couple more slides. All right, the Institute for Nonprofit News is a consortium of almost 200 of these non-commercial. Their role models for KKFI radio is KBOO radio in Portland, Oregon, who have a half an hour news broadcast daily and weekdays. They have one professional journalist on staff, and they have the daily news produced by a couple of hundred volunteers that rotate, and they have an ongoing training program, and we're talking about doing something like that here. And Monica Bauerlein led a panel on big dollar fundraising at INN Day's conference last June in Orlando that I attended. And she's the CEO of Mother Jones. She and her editor-in-chief won some prestigious PEN America award for producing serious investigative journalism that the evaluators said put bigger, more deep-pocketed, established papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times to shame. They did it by identifying somehow potential, in part by identifying potential big-dollar donors and making specialized pitches to them, in addition to a lot of other activities. And the Institute for Nonprofit News has said that small nonprofit news organizations need to engage in a variety of different outreach methods, subscription models or donations like KKFI or KCUR and special events like KKFI has organized here in this room. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had Medea Benjamin, and a year and a half ago, we had Juan Gonzalez, who talked specifically about whether local investment, local governmental investments in urban redevelopment since 1920 have actually benefited the bottom 99.5%. Yes.
Yeah, I guess I'm getting confused. So it's okay to depend on big donors but not advertisers. Couldn't the same sin happen on both sides? I mean, if you're appealing to donors, and even case you are, I love case you are, but let's face it, I mean, the sustaining members and the there's huge companies that are supporting them and they're getting advertisements all the time. So if the money is still coming from the people with the deep pockets, I'm not seeing a real difference.
Excellent point. I think the key question is you need, for KKFI, we have a mission to serve the underserved, basically, and we need to keep focus on that mission. And the Institute for Nonprofit News requires all of their members, and KKFI is not a member, but I'm talking about maybe, and neither is Friends of the Community Media, but I'm talking about moving in that direction. They require you to advertise all your big donors. I think we also need to establish an endowment so that if we get an income from big money that's more than 1 or 2% of our annual budget in any given year, the excess over that needs to go into an endowment from which we can draw maybe at most 5% a year to fund operating expenses, to give us editorial independence, so that we don't have to look over our shoulders about who we might offend. And certainly during the INN discussion of soliciting funds from big donors, they talked about, okay, if you're going to be concerned with if we find something that's a problem for you, okay, we want you to still be accept it, still understand that we're going to have to publish it, right?
As you noted in your slide on Eisenhower and the history of Vietnam, in my view, that was caused by a tremendous amount of propaganda, as you noted also. Right now, we have the Cambridge Analytica company that is coming. They were exposed for a while and then have suddenly sort of disappeared. But their message and method of weaponizing propaganda has not gone away. How do you suppose that future media activities are going to be able to deal with weaponized propaganda?
That's a serious question. I mean, the Vietnam War. I mean, the Soviet Union at that time was big, and it was powerful. It was nowhere near as powerful as we were led to believe, but it was. Today, I've got a Wikiversity article on winning the war on terror that talks about that, and my answer is we need citizen-directed subsidies for journalism because, for example, in the war on terror, men in the United States are more likely to die from breast cancer than terrorism. Not just women, men. In the year 2001, almost as many men died in the United States from breast cancer as died in the September 11th attack. More people die on average every year drowning in bathtubs, hot tubs, and spas in the United States. So we already have. In the war on terror, if you think about it, it ought to be bloody silly, except thousands of people are being killed with our tax money. What else? I think, serious review. We need an international system that says, that collects data to answer George W. Bush's famous question on why do they hate us. I mean, he gave a propaganda answer. We need a serious answer. General Petraeus gave a serious answer in his book on My Share of the Task. He was in charge of, had various command positions in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said, we never talked to any first-time jihadist who did not agree, or every first-time jihadist we talked to said that the revelations of Abu Ghraib first shocked them out of complacency into action. So terrorism works. I mean, so torture works to manufacture recruits for our opposition. Now, there's another issue. In 1999, an America West flight made an emergency landing when some goofball was trying to break into the cockpit. The FBO went on board. The apparent perpetrator produced a Saudi passport with a ticket apparently paid by the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. The FBI says, oh, that's out of our, you know, we're not authorized to deal with that, right? That information was classified top secret to keep it evidently from the American public, all right? The Saudi government, and I think there are a whole other strain of research that says that the number one recruiter for an Islamic terrorism is Saudi Arabia, and the number two is United States, all right? So we need a full and open, honest discussion of this, and I think, and I'm not certain how we're going to get it, but we're not going to get it from the mainstream commercial broadcasters, and we're not going to get it from people like, from frankly, public broadcasting system that depends on both advertising and government funds without citizen-directed subsidies.
People need to want information. I don't even know how to put that into a question, let alone have an answer for it. And changing the subject a little bit, your last statement, was it written down, the last statement in your speech, was it written down? It seemed monumental.
We can create a local political economy that is safer and more prosperous for everyone, with the possible exception of the top 0.5%. Is that what you're talking about? The mainstream media create the stage upon which politicians read their lines.
Okay.
Right? And that's as a matter of fact part of why I'm volunteering with KKFI. Okay, because we can we don't have a regular news program, daily news program yet. I'm inspired by the model of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, and I'm hoping we'll be able to create a regular training system that will recruit and train a system of volunteers. I've got KBOO's training materials. What I don't have yet is a consensus to build a regular, you know, to train trainers and build a regular schedule and a commitment to do basically what they do. A woman named Lisa Loving has written a book on titled Street Journalist or something like this, Street Journalist or Street Journalism. And she's been the key spark plug at KBOO on this issue for many years. She says that 90% of the people they train who go through their training program never produce any news for KBOO. But they love the station and they support it in other ways, right? And the other 10%, you know, serve a day or so a week producing news that gets compiled into their daily news broadcast. And another thing that I'm experimenting with in this is using Wikiversity. I don't know how many... Let me talk about the Wikimedia system. You all know about Wikipedia. Well, Wikipedia is one of many projects of the Wikimedia Foundation. One of their other projects is called WikiNews, and they have that's supposed to be, and they try to be like professional journalists. Another one is Wikiversity that has a more of a education, teaching and research. So it's a platform for sharing educational materials and research. Wikipedia is an encyclopedia. And so original research is strictly forbidden on Wikipedia, but it is encouraged on Wikiversity. And so I've been writing a bunch of stuff and publishing it on Wikiversity, doing careful research, the Wikimedia system has three basic rules. You should write from a neutral point of view, citing credible sources, and treating others with respect. An author writing in a Canadian librarianship journal said that when it came to Wikipedia, there was basically no other platform he knew of where people with very different views can actually come together and hash out a common narrative that all can more or less live with.
We're right at the time to quit. I'm going to put in a plug for an idea that a few of us have been wondering about. You introduced this today, pointing out the drop in employees at the Kansas City Star. Most local media, the people who report on our current political contests and so forth, are owned by corporate and out-of-town owners, whether that's print media, broadcast media, internet. How much money would it take to go to McClatchy and offer to buy the Kansas City Star and sell the shares to the public in Kansas City? We'd need somebody with a few million dollars who was interested in doing it to begin it. You don't have an answer because I raised it. Somebody raised it to me. But another approach is, if the Star is in so much trouble that it has to keep shedding employees, how would we make it a locally owned piece of media that really did report on the accident at the corner, what the snowstorm's actually going to do in Kansas City as opposed to the region, and so forth. Spencer, thank you for your time. I'm not expecting an answer on that. I'm just...
If I can offer a couple of comments?
If they are brief, because we need to close up for the service.
Just very brief. Just being audacious, we could go to McClatchy and ask them what they would be willing to part with it for, right? We might be surprised.
Okay. Thank you very much for all who've attended. Thank you, Spencer, for dealing with us today. And I'm looking to see, as a thank you for speaking to us, here is our mug.
Wonderful.
From the forum.
Thank you.
I believe Made in America, and
wonderful.
Remind being
thank
here.
You
thank
so
you.
Very nice.
Spencer will be available down the hall, I believe in the library, for anybody who'd like to continue this discussion. The service that follows shortly, you are all welcome to join us, attend there, and thank you for coming.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Local News Coverage with Spencer Graves. This program was recorded on Sunday, March 3rd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.